Welcome and thank you very much for joining us on episode 105 of the Blazers Edge podcast, presented to you today by BlazersEdge.com. I'm your host for the weekend, Chris Lucia. If you need to get a hold of us at the show, you can do so anytime by emailing us at BlazersEdgePodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to hop on iTunes, where you can rate, review, and subscribe to the Blazers Edge podcast. You can also hear us on Stitcher as well. Joining me this week on the Blazers Edge podcast is Oregonian Blazers beat reporter Mike Richman. Mike, thanks for coming on the show this week.
Appreciate you having me, Chris.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about the Blazers going on. Lately, there's some up and down trends on the court. We had the Sixers game, last week. Before that, there was the Oklahoma City win. So it's kind of up and down. There's a lot to talk about. But before we get into the Blazers talk specifically, I want to ask you a little bit about the podcast you started this year.
Oh, well, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to plug my own stuff. I have a weekly podcast with my friend Charles Tuggle called the My Friend Chuck podcast. This is one of my good buddies from college, and basically we would call each other every 10 days or so, and he's a huge NBA fan and lives on the East Coast. And we would spend, 30 or 45 minutes sort of running down the stories in the NBA and talking about things. And so we got together this summer, and I realized that I was no longer just like some dude who happened to cover high school sports, but I actually found myself in the midst of being an NBA beat reporter. And so I said, hey, Charles, would you like to start a podcast? And we did. And it is called the My Friend Chuck podcast. We usually record Sundays or Mondays. It's weekly. It's really excellent and much better than the Rip City Report, which is a terrible podcast.
Ouch.
No, just kidding. I don't think Joe or Casey, who hosts the Rip City Report, listen to this. But if those guys are listening, you guys have an inferior at best podcast, and an embarrassing, most likely, embarrassingly worse, more accurately. So please listen to the podcast, My Friend Chuck. We're on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher. Subscribe. Give us a review. Last time I requested reviews, I like went out of my way to be like, please review. Someone gave us a terrible review. Basically like, here's a one-star review. I don't like you. So I've learned my lesson. You reap what you sow. Asking you shall receive. So that's my podcast. You can also follow me on Twitter at Mike T. Rich, and you can read all my stuff, OregonLive.com/Blazers. And I think that is a really, for the first 2 minutes of this podcast, what an excellent chance to plug my stuff. So let's talk hoops.
No, it's great. I appreciate having you on. And before we get started real quick with the reviews and getting comments on the iTunes and stuff, that's like pulling teeth, man. You like you mentioned, you ask for that, you beg for it. And the one you do get ends up being really horrible. So all the listeners who are listening to this right now, open your iTunes, go search My Friend Chuck and the Blazers Edge podcast. Give us some reviews, some comments, if that's something that you feel like doing. We'd really appreciate that. But moving on to the basketball talk, like you said, there's so much going on. I think at the forefront of a lot of Blazer fans' minds recently, it seems like, has been kind of a lot of trade talk. And mostly it kind of involves CJ McCollum. So I'm going to ask you, I guess, right off the bat, Mike, what do you really make of this trade CJ McCollum talk one way or the other?
Well, my first reaction is that everyone loves trade talk. That's like the thing that the average fan, and even the really passionate fans who follows the day-to-day, they love that stuff. Who doesn't love player movement and, oh, what if we got this guy? What if DeMarcus Cousins was a Blazer? What would he look like? Type of thing. That's like why in free agency you see like all those people spending time photoshopping heads onto new jerseys and all that type of thing. And also, it just the way this Blazer team is made up. Who the hell else are you going to trade?
I mean, like, at this point, I'm not really sure. I mean, you can't trade that pick until draft day. So
right, you can't trade. They don't have a first rounder to trade. The sort of tradable veterans, Gerald Henderson and Chris Kaman, aren't super sexy players to trade. Is there a big market out there for a guy like Ed Davis or Mason Plumlee? Probably not. And also, they're probably not available. Alan Crabb, I have said before, is probably maybe the most tradable piece because of his skill set and how cheap he is. But like, the Blazers aren't trading Alan Crabb.
No, I mean, dollar for dollar, that guy's got to be one of the better, more important players on the team this year, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think he's the biggest winner of this whole season, as you kind of find out how, like, if you were to give Alan Crabb 29 minutes a night, how good would he be? Well, he's pretty good.
And what do you get back for $950,000 in salary?
Right? Probably some team trading you a fairly overpriced part, because the Blazers are so far under the cap that they're able to make unbalanced trades. But I don't know. There's nothing about this season that would suggest that the Blazers want to make an unbalanced trade to trade a 24-year-old for an expensive veteran. It just doesn't fit the bill. So you know, by process of elimination, and let me just, as long as we're going down the roster, it's hard to trade Myers Leonard because he's going to be an unrestricted free agent this summer. And it's hard to trade Damian Lillard because A, he's the face of your franchise and there's no way in hell they would trade him. And second, he just signed a $120 million extension. So that's a huge commitment from that you're asking for another team to make. So just the way it all works is that the reason why people are talking about CJ McCollum being the person, or what could you trade for CJ McCollum? He's the most valuable trade chip, and he's the most viable trade chip. That being said, I am pretty staunchly in the don't trade CJ under almost any circumstance. And I also think that I said this before, but the window to trade CJ McCollum is like February 18th. Because next year he's a restricted free agent. And, you know, I don't know if there's going to be a big market or a valuable market for him where you trade him this summer or next year, in which he's a restricted free agent. And so he would have to agree basically under the table, wink, wink, with another team that he would sign, or a team would have to gamble that they could re-sign him. And so then there's just a lot less value in trading him. And to take it a step further, another reason I'm not into trading CJ McCollum is because it's hard for the Blazers to get good players. And CJ McCollum is a really good player.
Right. And you know, the thing about trade talk, and I know it's super fun, and I know, you know, these days with the popularity of fantasy sports, you know, particularly daily fantasy sports is blowing up now. You know, you have video games, 2K, blowing up. I mean, it's been popular for the better part of a decade.
Yeah, I've been great as a GM in 2K. My career as a 2K GM is really flawless.
Exactly, and I think that's kind of indicative here of what kind of is spurring a lot of this talk is there's a fair amount of, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but kind of armchair GM analysis, right? Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at it, you kind of see the armchair GM, so to speak, saying, this is the guy we can get for CJ McCollum. And you see people firing up the ESPN trade machine.
I was going to mention ESPN trade machine is just a terrible tool.
Right? And well, my thing with that is if you look at last year with the Aaron Aflalo trade, I don't necessarily think anybody saw that coming the way it did. I think it was, if I remember right, it was Wilson Chandler, Wilson Chandler, Wilson Chandler, if the Nuggets were to trade anybody. And so you get that a follow trade, and then for Barton and Robinson and the first rounder, I don't remember anybody really predicting that particular trade. If you go back to this summer, I don't think anybody called Steve Blake in a first rounder for Mason Plumlee. I don't think anybody called Nick Batum to the Hornets for Noah Vonleh and Gerald Henderson. And if you keep going back in time, you see that the majority of the trades, as people who follow the Blazers, what we've seen seems to have come out of left field. Is that something you can kind of agree with?
Yeah, I think the Aflalo trade was, the Aflalo trade was a little bit closer to being, to people knowing about that than the other ones you mentioned. I think that obviously Wilson Chandler was the name everybody wanted, but and I don't know if this was totally reported, but the Denver was asking a lot for Wilson Chandler. They wanted two first rounders, and that wasn't going to happen from any team in the league, which is hence why Wilson Chandler is still on the roster. But I think Aflalo was a name that was floated out there. So I think people knew that was a chance. And at the time, this was like the most tradable players on that team were Will Barton and Thomas Robinson. But generally speaking, I think you're right. I think most of these trades happen quickly and behind closed doors. And they're not the type of thing where you spend a season, what can we trade? You know, he's our trade chip. What are we going to get? 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 And that'll be tested as we enter the trade deadline with Henderson and Kamen, because I think everyone in the league and people who follow the team closely know that those are sort of the names that are most likely to be moved.
So you kind of mentioned a little bit earlier that kind of by process of elimination, more or less, that CJ seems to be the most tradable guy. If you kind of look at his contract, it's fairly reasonable. It's going to be attractive to other teams. If you look at his production on the court, that's obviously going to be attractive if you combine that with his age. And
top 20 scorer is pretty good.
Exactly. I mean, so he's has some value there to other teams. But I'm thinking, you know, why would the Trailblazers want to trade him? And a couple of ideas that I've heard floated around quite a bit, you know, or I should say the reasons why a lot of people would be willing to get rid of him is because his skill set kind of replicates what Damian Lillard does on the court, at least offensively, and I guess to a degree defensively as well. I've heard kind of the narrative that, you know, these two guys in a starting backcourt together will never be able to really, you know, make it to prime time. I guess you could say they don't really have what it takes on the defensive end to really be in a finals contending team. You know, I think it's kind of common knowledge that both these guys, you know, have had struggles up to this point in their career with defense. Do you think that's kind of a legitimate concern looking forward, that these two guys, you know, playing and starting in the same backcourt together, that's going to kind of be an issue on the defensive end?
Yeah, somewhat. I think that there's a reasonable concern that 2 6-foot-3 guards, particularly whoever you consider the two guard in that lineup, most sort of common knowledge would be that it would be McCollum, but whatever. That they would have some defensive issues. But I've pointed this out before. The Blazers' best of their 12 most used or 11 most used lineups, these are lineups who've played at least 40 minutes together through the first half of the season. The Blazers' lineup with the best defensive rating includes both little guys, includes McCollum and includes Lillard. It's Lillard, McCollum, Harkless, Aminu, and Plumlee. I would argue that Plumlee is not even a particularly good defensive center. While I think there's some reasonable concern for the McCollum and Lillard pairing on defense, I think as much as anything else, it matters who they have around them. You're just going to have to build a non-conventional team. You might have to build a team where Aminu plays a ton of four and you switch a lot of stuff and you get a true rim protector to try to sort of anchor the rest of the defense. Is it a challenge? Yeah, it's a challenge, but it's a challenge to build any good team in the NBA.
And we talked earlier a little bit, you know, we kind of mentioned that, you know, CJ McCollum, you know, we talked about these defensive issues, and I kind of mentioned that I don't particularly like throwing out specific names, you know, that a guy could get back on the trade market, because a lot of them just seem to not really be what you expect, right? So as opposed to saying, you know, CJ McCollum for such and such player, I guess, in your opinion, if the Blazers were looking to trade him hypothetically, what kind of guy would the Blazers be looking to bring back? Are they looking to bring
the same player that every team in the NBA wants back, and it's an elite wing?
So are you saying that this is going to be a bit more of an uphill?
I mean,
climb?
isn't what everyone wants when they say trade CJ McCollum? They want to trade George Hill for Kawhi Leonard. Isn't that what everyone's talking about? Like, isn't that the sort of in the back of everyone's mind, is they want to trade George Hill for Kawhi Leonard, and they want to say, here's a really good young prospect. Here, we're going to ship him out for Kawhi Leonard. You know, like, there's just not that many of those guys available. And if they are available, and Kawhi wasn't this good his rookie year, he was pretty good, but the Spurs were freaking great, so it's able to hide them. The Blazers aren't in a position where it would be reasonable for them to take a short-term step back in terms of talent to hope that the long-term, two years down the road, 2.5 years down the road, that it's clear that they were that they made the right choice. I can't imagine that would be the direction they would go. And how many Kawhi Leonards are there in the world? How many really good wings are there in the NBA?
I mean, there's pretty much a handful
Five?
Of them, and the ones who are seem to be kind of those guys who aren't really going to be put on the trading block by the teams who have them.
Yeah, so then you've got to make a trade for someone who's like pretty, for a promising prospect. And the Blazers are a team full of maybe not promising, but they're a team full of budding prospects, or just prospects in general, whatever you want to term it.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, you know, a name that I'm kind of looking at that, you know, in terms of not, he's not superstar level, but he's incredible on the defensive end as a wing, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, but I don't think that's they're going to be willing to trade their 6'7" guy who can defend, you know, three, four different positions, you know, for a guy like CJ McCollum who struggles on the defensive end. I just don't see.
Also, wouldn't the Blazers be worse with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, like in the immediate future, depending on what they do at two?
I mean,
because of his inability to shoot. Yeah, like, and that's the thing. It's like, there's a lot of factors that. This is what I said about trading Nicholas Batum at the time too. Like, I think it was probably better for both parties, the Blazers to move on and for Nicholas Batum to move on. But it's almost certain that in the immediate future, the Blazers were going to take a step back on the wing, because even as bad as Batum was last year, there just aren't that many good wings in the league. That's what there aren't. There are a lot of good point guards, a lot of good little guards, a handful of good young centers, and a lot of mediocre wings. Not even mediocre. A lot of limited wings. A lot of Allen Crabbs. A lot of guys who are really good shooters and good defenders but can't create on their own.
So I guess while we're kind of talking about Cool Breeze, and you mentioned this on the My Friend Chuck podcast earlier this week, I believe, you were kind of kicking around the idea of maybe starting Allen Crabbe and then bringing CJ off the bench as this kind of explosive sixth man. But you kind of pointed out that that's kind of already somewhat the case, is he's leading the second unit, right?
Yeah, I mean, isn't there this camp that says, and mostly it has to do with CJ's height. This is like a height thing, a heightist thing. This is, if I'm saying before that everyone who's talking about this wants to trade Kawhi for George Hill, I'll use another example. This is everyone who's a fan of Jason Terry. These are Jason Terry fans. And I think CJ McCollum is better than Jason Terry. But still, this is like a whole group of Jason Terrys out there who are like, well, you can't be a small two guard and start in the league. And there's this camp. I get emails, I get tweets about this all the time, that CJ would be best as the leader of the second unit and as a spark plug off the bench. Well, if you've watched any of the Blazers' first 45 games this year, CJ McCollum is the leader of the second unit. So they're doing that. That's done. You can check that box. don't worry. He made it. He made it to the exact role you wanted. While you were clamoring for it, he had already been put there. And probably the best thing Terry Stotts has done this year is balance the starting lineup and the bench lineup. It's a little weird to have Vonleh in the starting lineup, but it adds so much. It helps the bench so much to have Myers Leonard and Ed Davis play together as the bigs on the bench. And it helps Noah so much to play with players who are better and hide his sort of limitations a little bit. And it allows for that bench unit to be really potent with a lot of space, because when it is the bench unit, it's either just Dame or just CJ out there. And it lets those guards have a lot of room to operate and attack. Which they maybe wouldn't if it was Ed Davis and Noah Vonleh playing together.
So assuming that, I guess most people can agree that this backcourt for the Blazers is going to need, they're going to have to add somebody, I would imagine, by, you know, whether that's free agency, some kind of a trade, or in the draft this summer if they're able to keep that pick. Assuming that they need to add somebody to that backcourt, what kind of a player do you think the Blazers are going to be targeting, you know, potentially this spring, or sorry, in February, closer to the trade deadline, or maybe this summer? Who do you see kind of, maybe not a specific player, but what kind
of type of player?
Type of player.
I would say another long wing type, like, obviously it's hard to find another Alfa Rukuminu, but that type of versatile guy who can guard 1 through 4 like really easily. That way it allows the Blazers to switch a little bit, and to, if they can, like you saw against the Hawks last night when they move Crabbe onto Schroeder and move Leonard onto Cephalosha Lillard on Cephalosha. Just a versatile defensive wing is what I think they're looking for, and a guy who can shoot and stretch and space the floor. So another 3-and-D type wing. And maybe more of a guy who's like in that 3-4 hybrid mold, a la Alfa Rukuminu. Basically, what they need to add is Mo Harkless on his best day.
Fair enough.
They need to go find Mo Harkless on his best day and either harness that and make him into always that good, or find someone who can replicate that. Because I really do think that it's non-traditional. It's a non-traditional type lineup, a little bit weirder lineups where you can succeed with the two guards, the Dame CJ pairing.
You know, I know he's 3 years older than Dame, and several years older than, you know, some of the other younger Blazers that are kind of considered to be a part of that core. But I assumed going into the season that Gerald Henderson would have more of an opportunity to kind of audition himself as maybe a key piece going forward and coming off the bench for the Blazers, like you mentioned, kind of a defensively capable guard who can guard a couple different positions. And I felt like Gerald Henderson was kind of billed as that player coming in. I know he struggled with his 3-point shot, but he's
all shots.
I know he doesn't have the best jumper in the world, but in terms of being able to play defense, you know, I was kind of thinking, you know, maybe this guy could be a piece going forward if they get him at the right price. Because, you know, 28 years old compared to Damian's 25 isn't that insane if you have that three-year difference. And I think that's kind of the claim, is that he's not in within the timeline. But I don't really buy that as much. But do you think he's kind of this season kind of played himself out of that kind of opportunity to maybe stick around with the Blazers next season?
A couple things. First of all, yeah, probably. I think he's gone. I'll just say that off the bat. Second, I think what happened was his hip surgery opened up room for Alan Crabb to play more, because CJ was always going to start at the shooting guard, despite what your 2K video game told you when you fired it up, when you fired that bad boy up in August and Gerald Henderson and Ed Davis were in the starting lineup and whoever that one guy is who I got into a Twitter battle with, some media member who I was like, listen, those dudes aren't going to start. I'm close to the team. Stop tweeting about the Blazers starting lineup. but those, it was always going to be CJ as the starting two. That was always the plan. And that was the plan from the moment things started shifting in July and they started retooling, is that the Blazers wanted to see what they could do with the core of Myers Leonard, CJ McCollum, and Damian Lillard, and whoever else they added who kind of fit the age range. So I think Gerald was always going to be a backup. I think that might have been misinterpreted by some people or misprojected by some people at the beginning of the season. And then Crabb played pretty darn well at the beginning of the season. And so it made minutes for Gerald, they weren't as necessary. There was not a demand like, hey, we need a veteran. Hey, we need a good defender. Hey, we need another, you know, we need a shot creator on the wing. They had a pretty good, you know, Aminu was really hot early too. So they had more shooting than they originally thought they had on the wing, and they had a good young part on the wing, and so there just was less early on. There was less room for Gerald, and he hasn't had back-to-back really good games all year long. He's been I've written about it a couple times. His struggle is consistency, and maybe he's just a bad fit. Maybe it's like Aaron Aflalo. Maybe he's just a bad fit for what they want to do here.
But I guess on the other side of that, and you mentioned this, I mean, Alan Crabb, Cool Breeze, totally stepping up this year, right? So would you say that he's going to be pretty high on the Blazers' priority list this summer?
I would assume yes. I would assume that Alan Crabb is very high, because I think my read on Olshay, and I haven't asked him this directly, but my read on Olshay is that he likes his guys, hence Al-Farouq Aminu is back in the fold, hence Steve Blake and Chris Kaman signed last year. Same with Mo Williams the year before that. Those are guys that Neil has had past relationships with in other stops, particularly with the Clippers, specifically for all those guys. But I think Neil likes his guys, and I think because the Blazers have the restricted, you know, because Crabb is entering restricted free agency, the Blazers have a chance to re-sign him if they want him. So I would assume he's very high on the list. And moving towards starter type minutes in the future is what I would guess they see him as.
I'd absolutely really like to see him back, especially if they can get him, you know, at a reasonable deal. And with the salary cap, you know, going up as it is, what's being considered a reasonable deal year after year, you know, gets higher and higher. So I don't know. You know, I talked to David McKay, fellow Blazers Edge contributor on the podcast about a month ago. And I asked him, maybe, you know, what do you think about AC's value to the Blazers? And he said, you know, we could be talking maybe by the end of this year up to $8 million. I mean, that's what.
Oh yeah, I think more than that. I would guess more than that. I think the going rate for a rotation wing is going to be between 8 and 9. So yeah, I wouldn't 3 for 27. Just to throw a figure out there, I think is a pretty believable price for what somebody like Alan Crabb could get on the open market this summer.
Talk about hitting the lottery for a guy.
Yeah, man, what great timing. I'm telling you, just fantastic timing for the next two draft classes to come up on their to come up on their rookie extensions when the cap is just absolutely going to skyrocket. And what terrible timing for guys who had to sign this summer and guys who have to sign in the summer of 2018 when the cap comes back down and kind of regulates and all these teams overspent for two summers. So sorry for those people. Congratulations to the 2016-2017 group.
Congratulations, Alan Crabb.
Yeah, big congrats, AC.
So we talked about a little bit. I mentioned the up and down play of the Blazers recently, and I brought up the Thunder game, the 76ers game. You had a couple decent wins on the East Coast trip, and then you come back and you know you drop a close one to Atlanta on Wednesday night. And what I've kind of noticing is this team is just it kind of has the mark of a young team, right? And the inconsistency, because one night you're beating a legitimate Western Conference contender. The next night, literally, what, three nights later, you're losing to almost an historically bad team in the NBA. I mean, that this is just what young teams do. But this also, and you mentioned this in an article you wrote Wednesday night, the Blazers, you know, before they lost that Atlanta game for 2.5 hours, they were in that eighth seed in the playoffs until the Kings beat the Lakers and took over that eighth seed. As we're speaking, the Blazers are what, half a game out of the
eighth
seed?
A full game behind Sacramento.
So this brings up quite a bit of talk whether or not this is, you know, would be beneficial for the Blazers to make the playoffs this year, or if it would make more sense for the team to, you know, not make the playoffs and end up in the lottery where they can keep that pick. Because as most people know, that's a lottery protected pick, right? So if they make the playoffs, the pick per terms of that Aflalo deal goes to the Denver Nuggets. If they miss the playoffs, they get to keep that pick. So in your eyes, I want to ask you, Mike, do you value playoff experience, even if it's a, you know, a 4 or 5 game experience against the Golden State Warriors or the Spurs? Do you value that as high as you might value a lottery pick for the Blazers this summer?
Well, hell, I value a week in San Francisco in April. These are my own selfish reasons. I apologize. I think that I don't want to undersell the value of making the playoffs. I really do think maybe when I was on the outside, I didn't always believe in this, but talking to NBA guys, that is a big, that's an important moment. Those playoff games were incredibly important for CJ McCollum to realize how good he could easily be. I said this on my podcast, and I really do believe it. I think it's more important for a team like the Utah Jazz with its core intact. They know what they're going to be in the next few years. They have, you know, the guys on the roster, assuming they're all healthy, and the Jazz are a mess, so who knows if they'll get healthy. But the Gordon Hayward, Derek Favors, Rudy Gobert, Alec Burks, probably not Trey Burke, but they have their four core guys on the roster. So right. Them making the playoffs, I think, is really, really, really valuable because it gets those four guys together, pressure-packed, the type of playoffs where, and more important than the pressure, the adjustments teams make, the subtle little adjustments teams make, and how teams adjust to your strengths and your weaknesses and all that, and then sort of seeing what playoff basketball is like. I think it's really valuable for a team like the Jazz. For a team like the Blazers, their core is not necessarily intact right now. I mean, who knows in 2 years how many players who are currently on the roster are still part of this group? Probably four.
It's depending hard to
know. Depending on what happens with Myers Leonard, but conceivably two. In a really weird world, one. You know. I think there's less value for this team just because the core, the team that. When the Blazers move from fringe playoff team to legitimate, you know, assuming that's the direction they're heading, assuming that that does ever happen, but when they move from fringe playoff team to legit playoff threat, if they had the guys on the roster, that core, then sure, that's super valuable. But for this group, I think the best case scenario would be them to finish ninth.
Yeah, I don't want to be, you know, negative or pessimistic or put down, you know, the Blazers. The specific players and the coaching staff and the front office, their, you know, their motivation, their desires and their effort to make the playoffs. I 100%, you know, believe the coaching staff and the players when they say that, yeah, they think they're a playoff team and they want to make the playoff scene. But I have to, I can't help but kind of think about the last several years with the Western Conference being stacked the way that it was. And I thought, you know, recently teams like the Phoenix Suns, who were kind of in that same position the Blazers kind of are now, surprising team, might make the playoffs, you know, kind of sneak in. New Orleans Pelicans last season. You know, teams like that, I feel like that's really beneficial in a really loaded Western Conference, because it takes, you know, what would it take at that point, you know, 40, 43, 44 wins a couple of years ago just for that right. eighth seed. But this year, it seems like the reason why a team like the Blazers would even have an opportunity to be in the playoffs at all is because teams ahead of them fell and aren't in the playoffs. And so kind of by default, it's whatever those kind of fringe teams are, they kind of end up in the playoffs. But if somebody's going to legitimately tell me that the Blazers, the Kings, the Nuggets, that these are legitimate playoff teams that could make some noise in the playoffs, I kind of have to question that.
Yeah, I'm with that. It's been a weird year. You know, at the beginning of the year, you would have said the Blazers are going to win 33 games and that'll be pretty good, but they're not going to make the playoffs. Now it's like Blazers are going to win 36 games and they damn well might make the playoffs. and they might win more than that. They could win 39. I mean, they're better than most people thought. But yeah, I'm with it. What I will say is this. I don't think tanking doesn't happen, and I don't mean like what Philly and the Lakers are doing, but I mean like actively trying to miss the playoffs or preserve a pick or whatever. It doesn't really happen. It very rarely happens on the court. Usually it happens with like how the fridge is stocked. And the Blazers have a fairly talented roster that's going to be competitive, so they're going to be there. And barring some injuries, assuming everyone's healthy, they're going to be... It's going to be tough for them to lose a bunch of games. They may lose. They may never beat one of the really elite teams for the rest of the season. You know, they may never beat a Western Conference playoff team. They've struggled against the East all year, so they might not beat another East playoff team. But I don't think they're going to be bad enough to rip off, you know, like they did 3 years ago, 13 straight losses to end the season. Because I think they're just a little, they're, like you said, the whole sort of West is down. There's some teams that you thought were going to be good that aren't that good. And the Blazers are just, they're talented enough to be right in the mix.
Right. And you know, those teams, some of those teams that we mentioned, like I said, those, you know, they just don't seem like, you know, playoff teams, like teams that are going to make a difference in the playoffs. It just seems like, you know, whatever team by default happens to be in that eighth slot is going to make it, as opposed to a very competitive race down the end of the season, like we saw the last couple of years with Phoenix, Utah, right. The Pelicans, the Dallas Mavericks taking, I think, a seventh seed last year, a couple of seasons ago. I mean, it was really competitive, and there were teams that had a legit chance to, you know, at least make some noise in the playoffs. But I think this year it's just kind of, you know, you're kind of lining up to be cannon fodder for the Spurs or the Warriors. And I personally wonder if that is, you know, if that's going to be as beneficial as it would be, like you mentioned, for a team like the Jazz, who they have their core together. They need to see what they have. They need to see how a legit contending, you know, NBA championship contending team does things, how they make adjustments. And like you mentioned, I just don't know if the Blazers are in that position right now.
Yeah, I'm with you. I will say this. The Kings are obsessed with the playoffs. The Kings team, like the players on the team, they talk about the playoffs a lot. You do not hear that from the Blazers. I think they have a much sort of wider view of how this season, a larger scope sort of how this season is going to play out.
Well, the poor Kings fan base, right? Like they deserve to see their team at least make an attempt to get to the postseason and do something in the playoffs. After all, you know, they bringing in Rudy Gay at the price they brought him in, you know, securing DeMarcus Cousins for the amount of time they did, taking that gamble on Rajon Rondo, and the litany of horrible draft picks that they've had the last several seasons. I think they kind of owe it to their fan base to, you know, give them at least four or five extra games.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. I totally agree. And I think the Blazers will try to make the playoffs, and they'll make a reasonable push. And there is I think I wrote about projections today on OregonLive.com, is that they've got anywhere from like a 20 to 30% chance of making the playoffs. It is a real, I wrote about it last night, and one of the first comments on the story I wrote was, ha, 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 playoffs. I'm like, Yeah, I know, man, but check the standings.
It could happen.
Look at the standings. Like, it's the middle of January, and look at the standings. Like, it shouldn't be. It didn't seem like possible in October. It seemed even like the trip right before Christmas, it seemed like a joke to keep talking about it. Now it seems like, look at those teams. Are the Blazers really that much worse than the Kings and the Jazz?
I mean, you know, you saw what they did to the Jazz last Wednesday.
Yeah. When the Jazz get healthy, you would assume they have a little more talent, but like, are the Jazz going to get healthy in time? And are they good enough to, if they're in a little bit deeper of a hole, are they good enough to rip off 5, 6, 7 wins against good teams and claw back in? We'll see. We'll find out. But yeah, I think the Blazers are like you said, they're in it. The climate of the league is such that they're not that good, but they're still right in the place, right in position to be a default playoff team.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising and it is exciting, you know, for Blazer fans to see this team that we saw, you know, the mass exodus of veteran players leave this past offseason, and then a lot of guys come in that a lot of fans weren't familiar with, you know, to see this, the way that Terry Stotts has taken this team and been able to get them to the point where we're even talking about the playoffs in late January is in and of itself quite the accomplishment, in my opinion. You know, when Vegas had them, you know, pinned, you know, for winning 26 and a half games this year, I think exceeding expectations is great. But in my opinion, I think the ideal scenario, and you mentioned this earlier, was to just miss the playoffs and still be competitive in every game. Because down the stretch, you're still going to be playing teams that care about playoff seeding, right? You're going to be playing teams who have a reason to win. So,
and maybe teams chasing 70 wins. So maybe even the top teams that in other years would have bowed out and said, cool, we're good. See ya. I mean, maybe the Warriors that last week of the season have 65 wins and 6 games left, and they really want to win 70.
Yeah, exactly. So even with, you know, the Blazers potentially missing the playoffs, there still could be a point down the stretch of the season where they're still getting, that core is still getting a ton of experience against veteran teams or teams that care about playoff seeding, and they're going to get, you know, the best shot from other teams. And I think it's going to be, you know, competitive at the very least for them. And I think that's, you know, that's pretty much the best we can expect.
Yeah. Yeah. 100% agrees.
So, you know, talking about playoffs, and we mentioned this a little earlier, CJ McCollum, how he kind of blew up in the playoffs, and that was really important for him last year to kind of see what he could do against a quality team and you know, what that did for kind of his makeup and or I guess his mental makeup and how he viewed the season coming into this season, starting for the first time. That was really important for him. But another guy who maybe isn't quite performing up to the same expectations after a solid playoff run against the Memphis Grizzlies last year was Myers Leonard. So I guess, Mike, I don't really know how to phrase this, you know, other than what the heck is going on with Myers Leonard this season?
Is the question, is Myers Leonard actually bad? Because I think that's the thing that Blazer fans are worried about. Yeah, okay, here's the difference in what we saw in the playoffs in CJ and Myers Leonard. CJ was just killing the poor Grizzlies, just absolutely roasting them. And he was going against pick and roll coverages that are standard across the league. Not standard, because they're blitz a little bit more, but you know what I'm saying, familiar across the league.
Right.
And top tier defenders. Courtney Lee's a very good defender. Tony Allen, one of the best individual defenders in the league.
Conley, if you weren't hurt, I guess.
Exactly. And you were seeing him go and get buckets. Get unrelenting, get buckets. It's 7 threes in the game that they lost in Memphis. What Myers Leonard was doing in the playoffs was exploiting a mismatch.
That's fair to say, I guess, against Marcus Gasol.
Marcus Gasol and Zach Randolph, they're not perimeter-type defenders. They are so glued to the paint, particularly Gasol, who's such a good rim protector. So what Myers was doing was more of a product of the matchup, where CJ was more a product of his just overall talent level. But that said, that's a small piece of the puzzle. The rest of it is that just simply Myers Leonard started off shooting poorly, and I think as much as you thought maybe last year helped him get over it, he still has some between the ears things where a bad shooting night or even a bad shooting quarter can stick with him a little bit longer. I've talked to him a little bit about it, and it's something he's still working with, just kind of shaking off some bad games. And he started off the year just so ice cold, and then he got hurt, and then he lost his starting spot, and there was just a couple things working against him. That said, and I think, before I say all this garbage, before I make these claims, let me say something. Over his last 12 games, he's shooting 47% from three on four attempts a game. Like
what we wanted from him.
He's getting there. And in those games, he's because he doesn't take a lot of twos, he's shooting 50% from the floor. So he's getting there, and he's become a better rebounder in those games. And, you know, he's strung together in the last month, I don't know, let me count them, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, he's 10 of his 20 games, 10 of his 17 games, he's been in double figures. He's starting to put it all together and to look like the player you thought. It's just he was so bad at the beginning of the year, just shooting-wise, just so bad at the beginning of the year that it's hard to look at his overall numbers and say, you know what, he hasn't been so bad, because his overall numbers, his shooting percentages are down. But if you look at sort of a smaller dose, it's clear that he can shoot. I think if you judge this season only in the second half of the season, it might be a nice way to say whether he progressed or not. The other sort of weird thing that's working against him is just the Noah Vonleh thing. Vonleh's going to play those 15 minutes a night. It's very important to the Blazers internally that Vonleh get minutes. And Terry Stotts has created this position for Vonleh where he plays 8 minutes to start each half, and that's it, and rarely, if ever, closes the game. He did it once against the Kings, I want to say, and I asked him that night about what it meant to play in the fourth quarter, and he could tell me the last time he played a meaningful game in the fourth quarter, and it was like 6 weeks before that. He's like, I think the last fourth quarter I played was against San Antonio. So some of it is like, why? It's like, what's wrong with Myers Leonard? Why can't he start? It's because the Blazers have figured out a way that it makes most sense to not have Myers Leonard start. And I think he really would like to start, but it's just not going to work that way.
I think, you know, Myers being in his fourth year, I think I'm going to try and gauge the fan base as much as I can, you know, from my experience interacting with them.
Yeah, I would say that Myers Leonard is the gets people charged up. I will say that. People get upset when you talk about, you know, there are people who are not. Myers Leonard is the person who gets people most angry, I would say.
And that's coming from a beat reporter who writes about the team every day and hears about this in the comment section and Twitter. So I'll take your word for it on that he's certainly the most polarizing player on the roster this season. You know, I think the first 3 years up until the playoffs last year, I think we, as fans, were kind of thinking, like, you know, he doesn't look that great. Hopefully he turns into something. Hopefully he at least finds some kind of a bankable skill on the offensive end and can hold his own somewhat on defense with that frame and the height and the size and the athleticism that he has. You know, everybody wanted him to turn that corner. And everybody was kind of, you know, it was either... You know, I think the first 2 years it was like, dude, what is this guy doing out there? Like, he looks lost. And I think that's a narrative that's been talked about by any number of people. Coming into year three, I think he had some struggles as well. And then you had that huge playoff game where you mentioned he was kind of more or less exploiting a matchup. Nevertheless, he did play extremely well last spring for the Blazers. And I believe down the stretch of the season, he wasn't playing too bad either.
No, he was good. I mean, he was in limited action, but he was 50-40-90 last year. I mean, he was good. Like he played limited minutes, but he looked like he was going to take a leap this year. And then and the whole contract situation, I think this summer sort of plays into how people are gauging his season.
So do you think, you know, in year four, you know, going into year five next year, judging from what your interactions are with the fan base, you know, and everybody else who kind of talks about the team, how much rope do you think Myers Leonard is going to have, going into next season, if he doesn't kind of turn that corner at some point this year. I guess it kind of depends on the contract he signs, whether or not he's able to live up to that. But
yeah,
just,
I was going
to
say, what team is he going to play for?
Just kind of point blank, though. How much patience do you think fans in Portland are going to have for him if he doesn't turn the corner this season?
None. I think he's the guy who people give up on quickest. Whether that's fair or not, I think he's, you know, especially with as well as Mason Plumlee and Ed Davis have played in spurts, that you say, like, you know what, there's other big guys out there, screw them. I think that at least fan base wise, people have less patience in him. And if he does sign a big contract this summer, because he is 7-1 and he does have shooting potential, and he's shown in spurts that if he's playing against a five, he's a pretty good defender. And if you don't put him in pick and rolls, he can be a good little anchor if he doesn't have to run around a whole lot. That's why he played well against Boogie Cousins, because the Kings just stand still. So if he signs a huge, huge, huge contract this summer, like if he signs a $4 for $60 million contract, which some people might think I'm crazy for throwing that number out there, but this summer is going to be weird. And Myers-Leonard is one of the beneficiaries of a weird summer. Then I think people really run out of patience with him, and if he's not good right away, it's the Nicholas Batum problem. Batum was pretty good, but he was never. Everyone always says, "Is he $12.5 million good?" Which I thought was kind of a stupid way to talk about him, but that's how it works. So I think Myers could be one of those guys who people run out of patience with. I whether that's fair or not, I think he has a few months to sort of earn everyone's trust back.
Is he more polarizing than Nicholas Batum has been to Blazer fans in the last several seasons?
That's a good question. There's a lot of stuff going on. There is this like sort of, I don't know how to phrase this, but there is a faction of fans that are, I don't know if old school is the right word, but there's a faction of fans that see a 7-footer and they want his ass in the paint.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen that.
Get him in the paint. It's like, well, he's not good at that. Why wouldn't you want him to do the thing he's good at? And there is a faction of fans that hate Nicholas Batum for being a French person. because that's like America's funniest rival, stupid France, and their Frenchness. For whatever weird xenophobic reasons that Americans that and I mean like Americans when I say that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like people who have like dudes who have like an American Eagle tattoo and a flag tat, like they hate France. So maybe Nick was more polarizing because Myers was like, people believed in Myers and they could kind of see that it was baby steps, and Nick was like already a developed thing that like wasn't realizing his full potential. But I think this year Myers is reaching that Nick Batum level where fans have lost focus. But I feel like that's a good Blazers edge poll. That's some solid content right there. Which player are you most? I don't really know what the Blazers edge the timbre of Blazers edge feelings for Nicholas Batum is at this point. But
it's so hard to gauge. I mean, because I wrote the player review of Nicholas Batum after the season. That's the one guy I really wanted to write about because I felt like he deserved to get defended after last year by somebody because he was just getting trashed. And I felt like, you know, he pretty much dislocated his shooting wrist in early November. That kind of screwed up his entire season. He had statistically the worst year of his career since his rookie season last year, is completely inconsistent. But, you know, I thought maybe that we weren't focusing enough on the fact that he was pretty much hurt all last season and trying to shoot with a dislocated wrist. And I think he hurt his back too. He had a really bad fall against the Bucks last year.
And he had some ligament damage in his elbow, and he had all kinds of stuff. And you thought maybe he would get it right after the All-Star break, and he came back with a really nice tan and had a good two games maybe after the break, and then never, even tan Nicholas Batum couldn't finish it off down the stretch. And I think, you know, lost in this is that he had a monster game one against Memphis. Monster game one against the Grizzlies.
Trust me when I say, though, that all this is leading to me saying that Nicholas Batum was polarizing on Blazers Edge. Like when I wrote that article defending him, it was like several hundred comments. Half of the people are like, I don't know if I would say half or not, but a portion of the people were saying, yeah, you're right. And a portion of the other people were like, dude, we are done with this guy. Get him out of here.
Yeah, well, luckily for those people, the Blazers felt the same way.
Exactly. We'll wrap here with one last question about Myers-Leonard, because I just think it's such a fascinating topic. We've been talking about him pretty much all season on the Blazers Edge podcast. He's really hard to pin down, based on some of that inconsistent play that we mentioned. But you did say that there could be a team out there, and it, you know, for all we know, it could be the Blazers.
Agreed.
Willing to pay him $15 million a year for 4 years, giving him a $60 million contract. That's not out of the realm of possibility. So what I want to ask you right now is, in your opinion, is he that guy right now? And if not, what would he have to do to get himself to that point?
He would need to raise his shooting percentage. He would need to continue to shoot in the 40 plus percent range from deep. And I think for Myers-Leonard to be really, really good, he needs to not just be like a pretty good shooter. He needs to be an elite level outside shooter. Because you saw last night against the Hawks, like when he had a couple of these plays where Tiago Splitter had these really slow closeouts and he got caught somewhere between taking a pull-up jumper and taking a floater and dunking, and he had these two really awkward finishes. So that doesn't seem like a part of his game that's really going to grow. So I think what's important for me is it's for him to be an absolute knockdown outside shooter. If he can show us that the second half of the season, continue to shoot like he has over the past 10 or 12 games where he's been a sort of back where he is, and that way he's passing up less shots and not getting caught in those weird in-between moments, then he becomes worth it. Worth that sort of level of contract. And I'm not saying like worth what Nicholas Batum's near max extension was 4 years ago in a totally different climate of the NBA. I'm talking about the summer of 2016 when the money jumps and he's a beneficiary, and what $10 million is a much smaller fraction or $12 million is what? Like it would end up being about 7% or something like that. Is that?
Yeah, if it's 109 million, yeah, you're looking at under 10% of the whole payroll.
Yeah, so then that's a pretty reasonable amount of money to pay for someone who's a very useful part of the rotation, definitely one of your three best bigs on a team that could make the playoffs. I think that's what you see, because I think that's key. And the big development for him, and it'll be a slow process if he ever gets there, is continuing to get better as a defensive player, guarding pick and rolls, guarding people on the move, guarding small guys on the perimeter when teams insist on putting a Jared Dudley type wing on him, improving a little bit incrementally on defense, and getting back to the point where if he lets it go from the outside, you think it's going in.
And so I guess last question, assuming his stats stay roughly the same, maybe he has some good stretches like he has recently and has some poor stretches like he did starting out the season and following the injury, assuming those stats say the same, what do you think is kind of a realistic price range for the Blazers to be looking at to have to either offer him or to match to keep him in town, assuming things stay the same way for him this year?
10 plus, probably. You're talking the difference between 10 and 12 million for if he's good or bad. He's 23, 7'1". Welcome to the league. Tall dudes get paid. Like, if you're going to get mad about that, watch another sport. Tall dudes get paid, and Myers-Leonard is going to be a tall dude if he's good or if he's bad.
Dang, that's an excellent take on Myers-Leonard, Mike.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you coming on this week, and obviously you're welcome back anytime. I want to give you another opportunity to talk about where Blazers Edge listeners can find your work on the internet.
Well, they can find it all over this mother... all my writing, if you're in the Portland area, pick up a newspaper, The Oregonian. I'm also, everything I write on the website, oregonlive.com/blazers, all my work, all my colleagues' work, as good a spot as any place you can land for Blazers coverage. I really believe that. And, I have a Twitter feed where you can find me at Mike G Rich, MikeGRich. And I have a podcast, a weekly podcast with my friend Chuck called the My Friend Chuck Podcast. He's a buddy of mine, and me and him talk hoops, mainly Blazer stuff, a little bit of NBA stuff weekly. You can subscribe on iTunes, the My Friend Chuck Podcast. And Chris, thank you so much for allowing me to pimp this out twice, both at the front end and the back end of this bad boy. So listeners who fast forward or only start early, they can hear me talking about myself.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on, Mike, this week. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris.
Alrighty, that's it for episode 105 of the Blazers Edge podcast. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today. I'd also like to thank Oregonian beat reporter Mike Richmond for coming on the show. If you like the intro music, as always, that's provided by local beatmaker and producer Odar. You can hear more of his work at soundcloud.com/odarbeats. The outro this week is provided by a guest. This week we have, and I hope I'm saying this right, Karmaic and Trey. If you want to hear more of their work, you can see that on soundcloud.com/TRAZZZ123. Make sure and tune into the Blazers Edge podcast early next week. You can hear Phil Nasons and Dave Deckard. I'm Chris Lucian. I'll be back with the Blazers Edge podcast next weekend.